are listening to The Real World on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded territories of Musqueam people at the University of British Columbia. The Real World is UBC Film Society's radio segment where we talk all things film. I'm back. I'm Lily Groh, and I'll be hosting the show this year. I was on the show last year, but I'm also joined by some other reoccurring guests and ex-hosts, so yeah. I feel very lucky for that. So here to discuss the 42nd Vancouver International Film Festival, which will be our topic of the episode, is Juan. First, say hi.
Hello, everybody. I've missed you.
He might sound a little bit familiar since he hosted the show last year. So thank goodness he's back. Also, we have Fernando.
Hello.
Another familiar voice. Can't get rid of him.
Despite our best efforts, he keeps coming back.
This is UBC Film Society's film liaison. So
yeah, I choose the films.
We should feel very lucky. He chooses all films ever, everywhere. So thank you for coming back, Fernando. And finally, we have none other than the Adam Groh to help with some of our movie-related trivia we're going to do that relate to some of the VIFF films we will be talking about. Adam is extremely world-renowned. He's so amazing for many, many reasons, but most importantly, he happens to be my dad.
Aww.
So say hi.
Yes, of the people on air, at least, I'm the one who knows the least about movies and film. But I do watch movies, and I'm a big fan of this show. So I'm perfect. I'm a great guest.
Yes, a perfect great guest ever.
Adam is the host of Cash Cab, and he was also our biggest donor in last year's fundraising event.
Yeah.
Still is owed swag, apparently.
So, yes.
this is the reason I'm on site.
Yes.
Maybe next fund drive. Yeah. Fund drive will be happening again this year, so you just wait for that. It was a great episode, and maybe you'll get your merch this year.
Love it. No, you will. You will get your merch. What do you mean maybe? You will get the merch.
So we're going to start talking about some of the films we saw at VIFF. Obviously, everyone here, not everyone here, so
Shade.
Saw quite a few films. How many did you guys get a chance to see, Fernando?
I did 16. I'm sure Juan did more.
16.
Yeah.
What about you, Juan?
I was able to watch 22 movies, but I was very lucky because, you know, I also covered the festival as a member of the press, so I was sent quite a few screener links. So I was able to watch 4 or 5 of the movies ahead of time before the festival
for
even
free
began from my computer.
Oh,
but yeah, I did watch 22 total.
Okay, wow.
How about you, Lily?
I saw 8 this year. That's all I got the chance to see. It sounds like not so much compared to you guys, but I was lucky that some of my 8 I got to see with you both. So we're going to try to talk about the ones that all 3 of us were there for. And we'll start off with Priscilla.
Mm-hmm.
So Priscilla is directed by Sofia Coppola, and it follows the story of Priscilla and Elvis Presley from when they first met when she was 14 years old in 9th grade, and Elvis was 24, already an established superstar, rock star all around the world. And it's based on the 1985 memoir Elvis and Me by Priscilla Presley, who then was the executive producer of the film itself. So I forget what you guys rated this on Letterboxd. Where did you guys land for it?
I'm a big fan. I give it 5 stars.
Big fan?
Yeah. I really enjoyed it. I like Sofia Coppola. And Kaylee Spaney? Is that her name?
Kaylee
Spaney? I have no
idea,
brother.
Yeah.
Yeah, Kaylee Spaney.
Yeah, she was
her
great.
Her performance is so good.
She took Best Actress in Venice, I think.
Yes.
She was great.
Jacob Elordi is like standing there making a weird accent. But she's so good.
She was so good. Yeah, he wasn't bad, but it's hard not to compare to the performance we saw last year with Austin Butler as Elvis. But yeah, I am a fan of Sofia Coppola. I think she's great. I haven't seen a lot. I feel like I'll always be comparing to like the ones that I have seen of hers. I've seen Marie Antoinette and The Bling Ring.
That's an interesting couple. Love in translation?
I have my priority straight. No.
No,
not yet. These are the only ones I've seen. But I did feel like we got like some of her trademark directorial things that she has done in her past work. So a lot of those like extreme close-ups that are like quick shots. So all of those trademarks I enjoyed. Also, fashion, I feel like, has played a big role in, at least I'm only thinking again of the three that I've seen of hers, but fashion as a way to express the leads, like, themselves, I guess. So I think that's cool. And then the three that I've seen have all had, like, a strong female lead, which obviously was great with Kaylee Spaney, as we already said, because I think she's a great actress.
Volpe Cup.
Yeah, that's the award.
Uh-huh,
that
lovely.
She got.
I'm just here for the facts.
I was like, Adam is giving us a new
was
language.
Was that from your
right
trivia?
No.
Okay, you were
I liked Priscilla. I thought it was good, but I am a lot more lukewarm on the movie than you guys are. I've only seen one other Sofia Coppola film, and that is Lost in Translation. I love Lost in Translation. I think it's a beautiful, beautiful movie. Priscilla, for me, fell apart in the script department. I feel like, yes, the acting was very strong from the main from the protagonist of the film. The set design was great. I loved how the movie made you feel claustrophobic. You know, all the scenes where Priscilla is in Sugarland, and she is very much... Sugarland, right? That's how it's called?
Sugarland.
Yeah. Elvis's house.
Graceland?
Yeah. Oh, Graceland. Yes, sorry.
Oof. Big oof. Sugarland is a game from your childhood.
Sorry.
Like some underground, yes. Like, I need to brush up on my Elvis fact.
Yeah, what the hell. But look, all the scenes where she's, like, you know, trapped in Graceland are very claustrophobic, very intentionally so. It feels repetitive. It feels boring, as it is meant to be. And I really, really enjoyed that. That said, for me, the script left a lot to be desired. I feel like the dialogue was very least common denominator, like not a lot of subtext, very overt stuff of what the characters are feeling. They're just saying it out loud. But then my biggest problem with the movie is by far the structure. I feel like the structure of Priscilla is just, in my opinion, not good. I feel like the movie spends quite a decent amount of time in the courting of Priscilla and how Elvis and Priscilla became a thing. And then the first couple of months of Priscilla in Graceland, that is also very much, you know, expanded into. But then it feels like by the end, Sofia Coppola is like, holy shit, we're missing 30 minutes and we still have like 40 more years of life to cover. And they just started rushing through wedding, children growing up. Elvis goes on tour. Elvis goes to Vegas. And like, none of that was able to breathe. And by the end, I'm like, I don't know. For me, it felt disjointed. It felt like instead of Sofia Coppola being like, okay, this is the message. This is what I'm building towards. And then these are the scenes that I'm peeking to, you know, further my point or the stuff that I want to say. It felt like Sofia Coppola read the book and was like, oh, I like this anecdote. I like this other one. And she was like, look at this. This is everything that happened. But it never came together for me, I guess.
Yeah.
And I do agree with you, Lily, 100%. Jacob Elordi, I think he did a good job. But I do think it is impossible not to compare him to the incredible performance that Austin Butler gave us last year. So for me, it's a lukewarm. It's a good. I like it, but it's lukewarm.
Yeah, well, I think I agree with you more than you think. I agree with you. I was just doing my introduction trying to do it justice because I don't think it's a bad movie, but like it fell flat for me. Yeah. I didn't get what I wanted out of it at all. I mean, I'm no expert on like their relationship or Elvis, but like I watched the movie last year and so I read up a little bit on their relationship. And so I feel like I kind of had these like landmark things that happened. They were young when they met. He moved her to Graceland. Then they had their kid. I had those already in my mind, and those were very basic, like, plot points in their relationship. What I didn't have is, like, what was she feeling? Like, there's all these extremely isolating things that are happening to her once they're together. So she's, like, lost so much freedom. She's lost her freedom of what she wears, her having a job, having friends over, like, all of these really important things, especially at that age. I can't even imagine how that must feel to lose freedom in so many of those ways. And still, after the movie, I still can't imagine how that might feel because they didn't tell me. Like, she walks around the house alone and I'm like, yeah. Like, I don't know. I guess to me, I was like expecting some sort of breakdown of like internal thoughts or something. I just feel like I'm still lacking understanding of like how that might feel for her. And I guess I just thought going into it, like, something that was, like, executive producer was her herself. It's based on this memoir. Like, I'm going to get this new take, something never before heard of how she felt when this was all going down. And still, it just felt like this layout of their history that I already had. And that's how I felt. But I also haven't read the book. Like, maybe that's what the story was and that's all that was there. Like, I don't know.
Is it possible, knowing a little bit about Sofia Coppola and what she focuses in on, not having read Elvis and Me by Priscilla, right? But what I know about Sofia and what you're describing, because I haven't seen the movie, and I told Lily I do this. I haven't seen the movie, but I react to what people are explaining, and maybe it is a decision by the director, more so than the producer, Priscilla, to spend time on, first of all, what the audiences have historically been really curious about. A 14-year-old and a 23-year-old have a relationship. That early part of the relationship, which you've said she spent more time on.
Yeah, she did.
And then early in the relationship, you're trying to discover what Priscilla felt.
Yeah.
And we spent a lot of time there. And then the rest of her life, I don't know what the biography says or the autobiography, but maybe that rest of her life was a bit of a blur for Priscilla. And it did go by.
Yeah, it could be. Yeah, that could be. And, like, I don't know. I guess I just, that's not what I wanted, which is, like, part of the tricky part about watching movies, because especially when it's based on someone's life, like, you can't have expectations like that. But, I don't know. And especially when it picked up pace, like, I didn't feel like myself building up, like, oh, is she going to get out of this? Like, this is so stressful. Like, time and time again, she's almost leaving, but she's not. Like, it felt like there were a couple points she left. She tried to leave, but then she didn't really, like, the momentum didn't build up for me enough for the final scene, which I think must have been, like, the point to be a little anticlimactic of, like, she's just like, no, I'm done. I'm leaving. And that's that. Spoiler.
Yeah. I kind of agree with you, and I think for me it was just for me the majority of the movie just felt like, you know, like the most basic obvious option. Like, the cinematography felt very basic, and yes, the fashion was beautiful and the makeup was beautiful and the acting was great, but the storytelling felt obvious. Everything was linear. Yeah, it like, you know, we've seen biopics do more interesting stuff. Yeah. With storytelling and with the order in which you tell certain stuff, but this one just it felt very vanilla, I guess, but mm-hmm. I know you disagree for them.
I don't like biopics. I'll start by saying that. I'm like, I just don't care. I can read a book on their lives.
Yeah.
And there's a few celebrities I care enough to read about them. So with that in mind, I really like that it, like, doesn't go into the specific details of everything that happens, because then I get bored. It's like, yeah, I know. I like Sofia Coppola staying true to what she does. I think most of her films are about herself, too. Like, Marie Antoinette, it's like a coming of age that just happens to star Marie Antoinette. And I felt this way about Priscilla, too. I do agree that the pace of the second half is very fast. But I don't mind. Like, I'm just happy looking at the beautiful costumes.
It is so beautiful.
Fair enough.
And just the set production to, like, her room and stuff, and how they use, I guess, like, what I was expecting is to hear more of her thoughts, like, when he is away, when she's still in high school, she's still living at home, and he goes away. I was expecting, like, to hear a bit more of what that might feel for her, but in Sofia Coppola, like, fashion, it more just, like, shows you these little kind of, like, things that she remind her of him, and it just has those really extreme close-ups of, like, a pin of his or a song, and, like, instead of hearing her talk about how much she misses him, it just flashes between a few very beautiful, like, things on her wall and things like that. So I guess that's entertaining in itself, that style, but I was maybe expecting a bit more, like, internal voice coming through instead of just those visuals, even though they were very pretty. That's how I feel about it. But in the movie, Priscilla, when Elvis asks her, he has her over to his house and he asks what her favorite Elvis song is in his very self-obsessed way. And she says, you guys know what I want to play. I want to play Heartbreak Hotel. But Adam, do you have a question that goes into this?
I have, here, and I can make this quick, plus you've got the benefit of. I've got three trivia questions related to Priscilla. and the last one will lead into the song.
Okay, go rapid fire.
Rapid fire.
And no time to waste.
And if you want to become involved with the Film Society at UBC, what do you do? I'm just curious to know, like, how do I become involved with Film Soc?
You follow our Instagram and you come to our events.
Yeah. Okay, beautiful. So here's the first question. Priscilla Presley spoke about her early relationship with Elvis, which has drawn criticism throughout the years because she was 14, he was 23. But she states that their connection was about her doing what to him?
I don't want to answer that.
Their connection?
Yeah, their connection is not what you think. It's about her doing what to him?
Everything that comes to my mind are things I shouldn't say on air, so I'll stay quiet.
Hence the reason I wrote it, because she denies that they even had sex.
Yeah, he would never do any of that because he wouldn't.
Yeah.
Well, of course they deny it, because if not, it would be 100% pedophilia, so it's in their best interest to keep it hush-hush if it did happen.
She claims, well, I mean, that's, you know, well, unverified, skeptical presumptions there. She claims in her biography, in her autobiography, and, you know, in relation to the film, that she listened to him. That their connection was based on him needing someone to talk to, especially about the death of his mother. Second question. Elvis and Me by Priscilla Presley is the basis for the 2023 movie by Sofia Coppola, as we know, and also the inspiration for what 1989 song by Depeche Mode?
The book is inspiration?
Yeah. Not only for the movie, but also this 1989 song by Depeche Mode. Not leading to the song you want. That's the next question.
Elvis, does it have Elvis in the title?
Nope.
Fernando knows the answer.
I don't.
No, you do. You're just being humble. I have no idea.
I don't know.
Depeche Mode's song, Personal Jesus.
Hell yeah.
They sang
Personal
about
Jesus?
Inspired by her, and to generalize, say that everybody in their life has somebody that is that savior to them, that special connection to them. But she talked a lot about how Elvis, for her, was someone that really was her personal Jesus, so it inspired that song. But to the song that you wanted, gentleman heard Heartbreak Hotel for the first time while he was riding his bike past someone's house in the 1950s. In the 1950s, this was a time when he says America was way more cool than Britain, which was in depression after World War II. And Elvis, Heartbreak Hotel, was actually like the sound of hope, if you can believe it, according to a member of what band? Britain in the 1950s.
The Beatles. No. Yes? Yes?
Yeah?
A member of the Beatles?
Yeah.
Who?
George Harrison.
I knew that.
Was an anthem for hope?
Yeah, if you can believe it. Like, if you think of it, when we listen to this song, for British, who thought America was the hippest thing ever, they were in depression coming out of the war, they needed something, and then all of a sudden there's this rock and roll guy and singing and just swinging his hips. Like, not that you can see it on the record, but they just thought it was a message of hope.
That's inspiring.
Yeah.
Hell yeah.
All right. Well, with that, we're going to play Heartbreak Hotel by Elvis Presley. I hope you are feeling hopeful after it.
Well, since my baby left me, well, I found a new place to dwell. Well, it's down at the end of Lonely Street, that Heartbreak Hotel where I'll be just so lonely, baby. Well, I'm so lonely, I'll be just so lonely, I
could die. Although it's always crowded, you still can find some room for broken-hearted lovers to cry there in the gloom. Be so, I'll be so lonely, baby. I'll be so lonely. I'll be so lonely, they could die. Tears keep flowing, the desk clerk's dressed in black. Well, they've been so long on the street, they'll never, never look back and think you're so, think you're so lonely, baby. Well, they're so lonely, well, they're so lonely, and they could die. Well, if your baby leaves you, you've got a tale to tell. Well, just take a walk down the street to Heartbreak Hotel, where you will be. You're so lonely, baby. Well, you'll be lonely. You'll be so lonely, you could die.
That was Heartbreak Hotel you just heard. You are listening to CITR 101.9 FM, still listening to The Real World, the UBC Film Society's radio segment. We just discussed Priscilla, the new Sofia Coppola film that we all saw at VIFF. This is Lily, Fernando, and Juan, I mean by we. And we're going to be moving on to talking about another film that we saw at the festival this year, and that is The Teacher's Lounge. So this is a German film from the director Ilgur Chadak. I hope I pronounced that right. Sorry if I didn't. The kind of rough plot of this was when one of the students of Carla Novak, the main character, is suspected of theft, she decides to get to the bottom of the matter. Caught between her ideals and the school system, the consequences of her actions threaten to break her. So what are your guys' general thoughts? Like it, didn't like it, fell off your radar? I know you guys saw a lot, so.
I thought it was great. It's a very, very solid movie. That's just the basic first impressions.
Okay, yeah.
I'm also a big fan. I just enjoyed it so much. We watched it together.
Yeah, Fernando and me saw it together.
And I loved it.
It was great. This was like an intense drama about truth and justice and systems of power, all focused like intensely on the ecosystem that is a school, like as kind of this functioning type of society almost. So it has all these layers of power, the people in charge, the principals, and then the teachers, and then the students, and these kind of rebellion campaigns. So it's got a lot of layers like that. Oh, I didn't see Anatomy of a Fall, but I read that it's kind of got, did you guys both see that one? Am I right? Okay. I read that it's got a similar kind of vibe to it, and it's less of a whodunit type of mystery and more looking at like how we actually deal with justice in society. Is that right?
Yeah, I've been talking with Fernando a lot about a couple of films that came out at this year's 42nd Vancouver International Film Festival. And first of all, I'm really impressed by the amount of films that came out about teachers and about how hard it is to be a teacher. Yeah. We had The Teacher's Lounge, we had About Dry Grasses, we had Monsters, we had Pwn. Way more teacher films than in previous years. And then I'm also very impressed by the amount of films that have come out in this year's festival that were all about the idea of, is there such a thing as an objective truth? You know, movies that never spoon feed you, this is what actually happened, this is the objective truth of what happened.
Yeah.
But instead, they just, you know, leave audiences to draw their own conclusions. And I am a big freaking fan of that. So that's one of the things that I love the most about the Teacher's Lounge. I thought the performances were great. I completely agree with you about how the movie, you know, how the Teacher's Lounge and the school in and of itself serves as a microcosm for society. You know, this is a movie that is all about, we are, you know, we are teaching the minds of the future and we are preparing them for the future.
Yeah.
And you have all of these teachers who are trying to make them better people. But at the same time, in the Teacher's Lounge, you see that some of the teachers are corrupt and are not the best people ever. So there are many moments throughout the film where you feel the hopelessness of the main character as he realizes, how can we expect these children to be better if we ourselves are not capable of being better? Throughout the film, there is a through line of things getting stolen in the school, and the children are getting accused of stealing. But then when you go to the Teacher's Lounge, you see that the teachers in the Teacher's Lounge are just as bad and are also stealing. So it's this vicious, hopeless cycle where how are things ever going to get better if, you know, we are setting the example for the new generation and we are just as bad as them, and then they will at some point grow up and set the same example than we do. So I thought it was great. I thought the script was great. I thought the dialogue was amazing. The performances was great. My only complaint about the movie is I feel like it didn't have an ending, and it was very frustrating. I feel like the film was building up in the most beautiful, delicious way, and things were about to explode, and then it just ended. And I understand that there are some movies that like to be like, oh, open for interpretation, we can leave it ambiguous, and, you know, you can decide what happens next. I like that. But for this one and this movie, this is a subjective thing. This is just myself. I know that not everyone agrees with me. But for myself, this example of leaving things up to the viewers felt more like a cop-out than an interesting, thought-provoking ending. So it was just like this beautiful build-up, and then I just got deflated, being like, okay, I guess. But yeah, it was great.
I see what you mean. Which side are you on, though, then? If you are like, do you want it to be a whodunit and we find out whodunit by the end? Or
no, you want
it to be like open-ended?
The resolution that I was seeking for was, I'm trying my best not to spoil, but the resolution that I was seeking for was not a resolution to the idea, to the question of who did it,
yeah,
who was the culprit. I don't care. I like that they left that ambiguous.
Yeah, yeah.
The resolution that I was seeking was in the relationship between the child, the teacher, and the child's mother. I wanted there to be something. I feel like those three never truly clashed and never got like that cathartic moment. Like, I was waiting for a moment where, like, the teacher just, like, freaking breakdowns and screams and cries. And, like, holy shit.
But, yeah, yeah.
You know, the closest we got was that little moment towards the end where she's like, okay, students, scream. Ah! But,
yeah,
you know.
That was even, like, anticlimactic for me.
I did love the opening shot of the movie, how she just stands up and raises her hands and everyone raises up. And, like, you know, she is the conductor of this orchestra. And she is inciting order in this people. And then at the end, she does the exact same thing, but then no one stands up. Like, you know, she has lost complete order. But that's my two cents.
I really liked it. I agree with you that it builds up perfectly. I think the music is great. I heard some complaints that it wasn't believable the way it rises. Was it you?
There were some melodramatic beats. I don't want to spoil them, but there were some bits that I'm like, come on, brother.
Yeah, when we talked about this, I remember you telling me that you can't believe how everything rises so quickly. But I liked it. It was just fun for me. There's some aspect of, like, I guess, nostalgia for German schools. I was just
oh,
like,
yeah.
Looking at they have, like, giant rulers on the walls, and I had that too.
That's
you're
nostalgic
thing?
For giant rulers on the wall.
Fernando's like, wow, this takes me back.
Damn, bro.
The good old days.
They used to steal my money in school. Damn, I'm so nostalgic. Take me back to Mexico.
Yeah, German school.
German school.
But it was fun. I liked how everything rises. And there's some levels like, yeah, this couldn't happen, but I'm enjoying it. The main actress, I don't know her name. She's also very good. The main kid is also very good.
Leonie something.
Benesh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Leonard Stetnitz. I just completely butchered that.
We're trying our best with names, okay? We're trying our best this episode.
My boy Leonard, I know you're listening right now. I know you're a big fan of The Real World. You killed it.
Apologies.
Yeah. So another film that I did not see.
Okay. Yeah. Surprise.
But I think that you'll like this. The three of you.
Right?
So this is from Jessica Kang in Variety magazine, which I'm just reading right now. So Jessica says this is no broadside against Germany's academic apparatus, nor even against the failings of educational institutions more generally. Instead, it makes the subtle but striking argument that school is not some sterile, cloistered haven in which we can safely prepare young minds for the challenges of the, wait for it, real world.
Yo!
No!
It is the real world.
Damn.
This is the real world. They're already in the real world.
Okay, I do have one trivia question for that, but then I know that I only have Swan Song trivia questions after this, but I wrote one right now. When you're in, whether it be a British...
You wrote one right now?
Whether it be a British crime drama or the teacher's lounge, when you're trying to find the actual culprit of a crime, what do you commonly set up?
A trap?
Clues?
What bee-like thing do you commonly set up?
Bee
or wasp or scorpion-like thing do you commonly set up?
Sting.
A sting, yes.
I love that movie.
Yes.
Wait, I never heard that in my life. What is a sting?
A sting? It's when you set it, you fake something to try to, you know, you like it's like kind of like using someone as bait to find the real murderer.
Fernando's nodding like he's done this before.
A sting operation. You've never heard of it?
No.
Okay. Wow. You've never seen The Sting, Paul Newman, Robert Redford. How dare you, Lily?
Sorry. No, I've never heard of that in my life, but good question.
You're welcome.
Just for future reference, if any of us are trying to frame the other, yeah, we'll set up a sting.
I would be like, well, what the hell was that bee-like thing? What was that wasp-like thing?
Various things that sting. What jellyfish-like?
Yeah, I mean, I really liked it too. I agree on a lot of fronts with you guys. What I feel is like, on contrary to Heartbreak Hotel, I feel like what it really took from me was hope. Like, this film, I think that, like, the main character, I think, will find a lot of relatability in the audience of this film, in that I feel like people tend to think that they're somewhat of, like, an exception to the system, and, like, that they alone, in their profession or in their life, can instill like hope in these children, and like they can be the change that we want to see and like help the next generation. But then she keeps finding herself in these situations where she can make decisions, the main character, and each time like I kind of empathize with her. It's not so much like a, oh my gosh, she's like asking for it, you know, she's gotten herself in all these horrible situations. I feel like I kind of empathize with her, and like she's trying to make these decisions to backpedal. She's trying to like help this situation that is a snowball effect of things that are unraveling once there's this first accusation of someone stealing in her school. And she's trying to help, but she's not doing the right things. But like, what is the right way to go about it? And each decision she makes, it gets worse and worse. And I guess like what I'm thinking about is what you said, Juan, of like this like contrast she has at the very beginning when she's the conductor and she has control of her students, to all of a sudden she doesn't. But there's this line that the kids are like, we never even wanted to go along with your like little song that you do at the beginning of class anyway. Like, we just did it because we thought it made you happy. And it just made me think of like, she not only is not some sort of exception, she isn't like the good teacher in the school who can make a change while like the rest of it's corrupt. Like, she never had control in the first place. Like, they were humoring her. But in that, when they said that, like, that's what I kind of lost hope for, of like people who think that they can make a change or think that they are, like, at the end, it's hard in a system like the school or like in society when there's so much corruption and like finding justice and things like that. That's what I'm thinking. I was like, by the end of it, I was like, whoa, there was no right way she could have gone about it, even though she's supposed to be this good teacher, like, with good lessons for her good students.
This might come up in your studies and sociology, and I'm maybe in already for you. This is sociology, because what you're talking about, what it sounds like you're describing, is institutionalization.
Yeah.
Is that a concept that's been discussed yet? And
maybe.
Does it ring any? Yeah.
Tell us about it, Fernando.
I'm good.
Well, you studied sociology. Is that what you're thinking of right now?
No, because like it, I didn't see this movie, but exactly from what you just described, Lily, you've got a good person with good intent.
Yeah.
And schools for many of us are, you know, as good as they might be trying to do, they're institutionalized.
Yeah, exactly.
And so sometimes institutionalized learning is not actually good. And you've got good pupils, you've got good administrators as individuals, you've got good teachers, but then they become part of the system and it doesn't quite work.
And yeah, so as much as like Carla, the main character, thinks that, like, and I'm not saying she is a bad teacher or anything, but at the end of the day, she's still a part of the same system that the rest of the teachers, the ones that are stealing in the lounge, the ones that are not giving as much attention to their students, she's still a part of that system, and she wasn't and probably would never be able to dismantle that, which is why my awkward transition was that, like, I lost hope from it a little bit of, yeah, there's only so much you can do, and she couldn't do that much. And that's why I think the ending was so unsatisfying to me. I was hoping she would have, like, made a change by the end, but she couldn't.
Fair enough.
I totally would have played, like, a song from the score, but then I went back and started listening to it, and I was like, this is actual torture to me. This is actual... Not because it's bad. Not because the score is bad. Like, shout out whoever the composer is. Like, I love it. But because, like, it's so intense. Like, in the perfect way that the movie is so intense, and, like, you've kind of got, like, this pit in your stomach of, like, oh, my God, everyone's making these decisions of, like, this is stressing me out so much. I think the score, like, does a really great job of conveying that. Anyway, so I was listening back, and to me, it sounds so much like the main track that kind of goes. Sounds like a ticking clock combined with, like, nails on a chalkboard. Put yourself in that situation. Like, you don't want to be there. Anyway, so I've decided not to play that for you guys. You're welcome.
Yeah. Thank you.
Inside track on Lily, by the way, when you're on a road trip with her ever,
uh-huh,
some people have their playlists and their great songs from whatever. Lily's soundtrack for a road trip is film scores.
Hey. Yeah.
Not film scores. I literally just played Little Women's score.
I respect that.
I'm not ashamed. It's my comfort. Anyway, so I'm not going to play that, but any last thoughts on Carla? I feel like I just talked a lot about her, but anything else, like the moral kind of lesson, that ethics that was coming from this, I don't know, that you guys want to touch on?
I think she's innocent. But also, this I do have a problem with in the film.
Okay.
At the beginning, when the first kid is accused of stealing, they deal with racism because the first family to be accused is an immigrant family.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a spoiler. It's like the first 10 minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's never explored further. So I would have loved to see that, especially when thinking about institutionalization. Is that a word? It is. But yeah, I think she's innocent. Free her.
That's it.
Justice for Carla.
That's a curious one. What's the director's name of this movie?
Ilker Chadak.
I always love to find out after the fact, and sometimes directors don't ever say it, but institutionalization of racism is very often just to make it disappear and it goes away. So I wonder if that was a choice by the director to, as an undertone. It wasn't dealt with, because that's what we do. We just don't want to talk about it. They hide it and it goes away. So that your experience with the film was to the real world. That's interesting. I wonder if that was an intentional thing.
I like that.
Yeah.
Could be. Yeah, I'm trying to think back of, like, when there's the scenes of them referencing their little, like, WhatsApp group that all the parents chat on, and they all, like, come to this teacher conference or, like, the parent night at schools, and they chime in on, like, whatever rumors are spreading. I'm not sure if there was a reference, like, a callback to that first scene, if his parents were present in that meeting, but maybe. I'm not sure. Anyway, I'm not going to play the song that I had to torture myself by listening to. It was very stress-inducing. I'm going to play a song that I just want to listen to. Did either of you see Swan Song?
No.
No.
Well, maybe we'll get a chance to talk about it later. You saw it?
Our special guest is seated.
Our other special guest. Would you like to introduce yourself? Say hello.
Hello.
Fernando's mom is here, and she has seen Swan Song, thank goodness. I wish you guys had seen it, but maybe we'll get a chance to talk about it later. I kind of just wanted to play Swan's theme, like the theme from the ballet, because I like it and I can do whatever I want. So.
Tchaikovsky was invited by a friend who was intendant at the Moscow Imperial Theater to compose music for a new ballet, this new ballet, which Tchaikovsky accepted, which is, of course, which eventually was Swan Song.
Swan Lake.
And Tchaikovsky said that he wanted to try his hand at this kind of music because not only did he never have a chance to do it, but he also needed what?
Money.
Yeah.
Hell yeah.
So true.
I got that one.
Respect the grind.
Me, I'm a big Tchaikovsky fan. Love him. Him and Joe Pesci, we go way back.
Yeah, yeah.
So Swan Song was another film that I saw at VIFF. Maybe we'll get a chance to talk about it later, but I want to listen to Swan Theme, the main kind of reoccurring song that goes through the ballet. So that's what we're going to play next.
Join Coquitlam Public Library for this year's speaker series, Conversations on Race, a five-part series running every Wednesday from October 11th to November 8th. Conversations on Race will highlight the lived experiences of people who have faced Islamophobia and anti-Semitism, as well as highlight the immigrant experience and Indigenous cultures in Canada, culminating in a workshop on allyship that will leave attendees with tools for how to speak on and tackle issues of diversity, equity, and inclusion in their daily lives. To find out more, visit Coke Library, that's coquelibrary.ca.
Are you a writer?
Listener?
Dreamer?
Music nerd?
Want to cover artists?
Visit venues?
Write something?
Events?
Personal essays?
Anything.
Submit to Discorder magazine and then take it a step further on Hail Discordia with your hosts, Zoe
and Izzy. Hail Discordia is an audio translation of Discorder magazine. We interview writers, play music and soundscapes, and do a deep dive of each zine issue. Hail Discordia plays at 1 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on the third Thursday of every month on CITR 101.9 FM.
Submit something for the magazine and come onto the show. Or just tune in and listen. We promise it's worth it.
Do you love being caffeinated? And do you hate that greedy, soulless international conglomerates are succeeding in the cutthroat world of coffee? Sounds like local coffee roasters Trek Coffee is for you. Trek Coffee is 100% indigenous and military veteran owned and operated. Let's keep small businesses thriving. Stop by Sunshine Convenience on 4th, the Super Value on Commercial, or grocery checkout in the Nest to pick up some Trek Coffee today.
Are you looking for ways to be a part of the community through low-stakes opportunities like volunteering? What about making friends that are really cool or have some common interests? Well, I'm here to tell you that at CITR, you can come volunteer at Volunteer Wednesdays, happening every other Wednesday from 12 to 3 with a really fun activity each time, like making signs or button making. Not only is it a great break from outside stress, but a great opportunity to be a part of the community. For more information, you can visit CITR's Instagram page at CITR and Discorder.
You were just listening to Swan Theme from Swan Lake, which I played because of Swan Song.
Wow.
Yeah, that I saw at VIFF. This was like probably one of my favorite viewing experiences at the festival this year. I thought it was very fun. I originally chose to see it because Karen Kane was like the artistic director at the National Ballet when she took over directing Swan Lake. I think it must have been a couple years ago now before her retirement. And this was all in Toronto, and Karen Kane, like this middle school that I went to was named after Karen Kane. So like, that's my girl. I had to go support her. Karen Kane School of the Arts. Like, I grew up with her. Like, she never came to visit the school while I was going, but like, I feel very connected to that girl, and I just had to be there to support. But I'm glad I did, because I'm not some like huge ballet person, but it was so interesting. I don't know like much that goes on behind the scenes and the art that is ballet, but I would definitely recommend seeing it. I feel like it reveals a lot of the effort they put in, and yeah, my image of ballerinas has completely changed. I didn't think that it was easy, but like, when you really think about it, like every other sport or like athletic thing, you're allowed to show that you're sweaty, you're allowed to show that you're exhausted, you're allowed to show like how painful what is happening to you is. But the ballerinas can't. They have to like look so perfect, and there's all these things that are going behind the scenes, like problems with their costumes and all this, but you can't see anything, and then like they just can't show the audience that. So I just think they're extreme athletes and they're all very talented, so I feel like it revealed a lot of that for me. Like they ran a 5K in just one act of the ballet, because like one of them wore one of those little things that track how far you run. Anyway, I couldn't believe that. They're like the talent and then the endurance that it takes. I learned a lot. Hell shout yeah. out Swan Song. That's my little shout out to connect to the song we just played. But Juan and Fernando are here with me. Do you guys have any other honorable mentions you want to shine a light on from the festival?
Okay. Yes, I'll be real quick. Okay,
okay.
I'll highlight my top 11 of the festival. I won't go into detail. I'll just mention the title. So grab
is this be a part one.
No.
That Juan is known for at the real world.
If you're listening, grab a pen and paper and start writing down, because I won't go into detail. My number 11, Hayao Miyazaki's newest film, The Boy and the Heron. Lovely movie. Lots of imagination. Lots of creature. Lots of fantastical worlds. I still got to watch it again, because there are some of the messages that I'm like, I have no idea what you were trying to tell me, Miyazaki. But I still very much enjoyed it. It was a beautiful, beautiful movie. My number 10 was another animated film called Robot Dreams, which at first I thought it was going to be this very silly, cute movie about a robot being friend with a dog. But then towards the end, I was in tears. It is the movie that reminds me the most of past lives in a weird freaking way. It reminds me of past lives. It made me cry. It's a freaking dog being friends with a robot, but it's so cute and So heart-wrenching. My number 9 was Totem, which Fernando and I actually watched in Espino, baby, at the first International Film Festival. Totem is Mexico's submission for the Oscars for International Feature. Mm. And it is just a lovely, incredible, beautiful movie about a girl who is dealing with something very hard in her life. Her father has a terminal illness, and the whole film is shown from her perspective. So you see the world through her innocence and her naivete. And the ending is heart-wrenching. Beautiful, beautiful movie. My number 8 was Red Rooms, which is one of the most disturbing and dark movies I've ever seen in my life. For those of you listening who know what a red room is in real life, then you know why this is so disturbing. For those of you who don't, I won't go into detail because it's a bit too fucked up. But it's a disturbing movie, but it's incredibly well-made, incredibly powerful. My number 7 was A Normal Family, which is a South Korean drama about a family that is anything but normal. Mm-hmm. They are all incredibly messed up, and they all hate each other in more ways than one. And then things explode in the most beautiful, chaotic, and bloody way. I loved it.
Sounds fun.
My number 8 was About Dry Grasses, which was a 3-hour and 15-minute Turkish film, which was very long, but it was very philosophically dense. It was about this professor who is tangled in this weird web, and it's one of those movies where you're following a character who is objectively an asshole, but it is still a fascinating movie to watch. The dialogue is just beautiful. Then number 5 was actually the newest live documentary from Sam Green called 32 Sounds. Sam Green performed it live here in Vancouver. It's a documentary all about our human connection with sounds, and it just blew me away. It's a very interactive documentary that asks you to close your eyes, shout, and break into dance in the middle of the documentary. I had the pleasure of interviewing Sam Green for my other radio show, Shameless Plug.
Oh my gosh.
No, we won't talk about that. But yeah, Sam Green, it was an incredible interview, and I love the documentary. Then my number 4 is Monster, which is actually the newest movie from Hiroki Koreeda, who is the director of Shoplifters and Broker. And Monster was actually the movie that won the Audience Award for Best Movie at this year's VIFF. So, we got to mention that. And Broker was just an incredible movie that it just kept unraveling and showing new layers of the film. And I was
Monster.
Just enthralled. What did I say? Monster.
Broker, too. I loved Broker. Yeah.
I love
Broker.
But Monster is a lot different than what Koreeda is used to doing. I loved it. Then my number 3 was Le Pot à Feu, or in English, they translated it to The Taste of Things, which is one of the most sumptuous, sensory, igniting movies I've ever seen in my life. It's a movie that is all about cooking and the art of cooking and, the beauty and the culinary arts. The movie begins with a 30-minute montage of people cooking, and it is one of the most delicious food-gasmic things I've ever seen in my life. Throughout the entire movie, everyone in the audience kept going, and like laughing afterwards because we were all aware of what was happening.
I hate that.
Oh, but it was an amazing movie. I loved it. Food has never looked this good.
Don't watch it in theaters, though.
No, do. It was the best experience I had in the festival. It was amazing.
Okay.
Communal foodgasms. It was incredible.
So
did you
true.
Watch it? Were you there when the foodgasms were hell yeah. And then my top 2 best 2 movies I saw in the entire festival. Number 2, Anatomy of a Fall, which won the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival, directed by Justine Triet, and it is a beautiful courtroom drama. I'm a sucker for courtroom drama, and this is just a courtroom drama in its most basic, essential form. It is just, you see courtroom drama from start to finish. You are asked to draw your own conclusions. It is also one of those movies about, is there such a thing as an objective truth? The performances were incredible. The dialogue was amazing. Loved
it. I gotta see it.
You do. And then my number 1 best film I saw in the festival was The Zone of Interest, which is just a movie unlike anything I've seen before. Extremely experimental, extremely weird, not for everyone. The movie is just a slice of life film where you're following the day in the life of this normal family, with the only caveat that this is a family of Nazis who lives right next to Auschwitz. And it is very hard, it is very powerful, it is incredibly philosophically dense, and it makes you question many, many more things than we would like to. But it is a powerful movie that, stays with you even afterwards. It is not plot-driven. Don't expect a story, but it is an experience. And it is one of the best sound designs I've ever heard, I guess. That is it.
Thank you.
Yes. My list is much smaller. 3, maybe a 4th honorable mention. Honorable mention would be Totem. It played at the festival, but I didn't watch it here, so I guess it doesn't count. Fallen Leaves was one of my favorite ones. Aki Kaurismäki. I don't know how to pronounce his last name. It's so beautiful. There's like people who are known for production design. We were talking about Wes Anderson before starting. But I think Aki has got to be like one of the best ones. It's just so, everything's so beautifully done.
Very visually beautiful? Yeah. Okay.
The story is also beautiful, but yeah. It's kind of depressing.
Okay.
It's about two people.
So a good balance.
Yeah, it's about two people who find themselves in, like, the background is the Ukraine war. It's always playing in the radio.
Yeah.
They both have horrible jobs. They're like, they can barely eat, but they find love in the middle of this tragedy. And it's so beautiful. It's so funny. He's like known for deadpan comedy.
Oh yeah.
And they just say the weirdest things and the audience is laughing at everything.
Did it catch the audience like off guard, or they knew what they were expecting a little bit?
First of all, audiences are interesting because they'll laugh at everything.
They're just there for a good time.
And they were laughing at parts that I could tell weren't funny.
Okay.
But when they were laughing at the
No, I hate parts, that. I'd be so annoyed. Were you annoyed that they were laughing?
It's part of the experience. Yeah. It's part of the VIF experience.
Just the vibes.
Yeah, it happens at every festival.
I see.
It's fine. Then that's my number three. Is that my number three?
Yeah. Fallen Leaves, number three?
Let's say number two.
Okay.
Number one is Here. That's the name of the film, Here.
Okay.
It's slow cinema. I watched it with my mom and the Rileys. Shout out to the Rileys. It's about a student or professor who's studying moss. And she just finds a random guy walking around in the woods and they fall in love. That's it. Slow cinema.
You would love that.
Damn, bro.
You like slow cinema, right?
I love slow cinema. It's showing slows up. Down. It puts you into a mental state.
Yeah.
Of just like existing in nature. Looking at, what is it?
Moss.
Moss?
Yeah, through...
the eyes.
Microscope. That's the word.
Through the microscope.
There's a lot of shots of just like nature. And it starts in the city, so... I know I didn't say anything because it's a movie where like pretty much nothing happens. But everything happens.
No spoilers, but spoiled the entire thing.
You just spoiled the few bits of plot that actually occur.
No, it's I want to see that, though.
It's not about the plot. It's about the moss. People. Hey, hell yeah.
All right.
Yeah, that was my number one. But also shout out to Do Not Expect Too Much from The End of the World.
Oh, God.
I wouldn't say it's one of my favorite ones, but it's one of the most confusing theater experiences I've ever had.
Shit was whack. That was the last film we saw of the festival.
Yeah, it's a perfect closure to the festival because I didn't know what was happening.
Okay. Well, sounds crazy. I wish we have more time to talk about that. Hopefully if you...
Part two, baby. No,
either of you are on later in the year, we can chat more about that one or any of the other ones you wanted to talk about. Today, we talked mostly about Priscilla. We talked about the Teacher's Lounge and highlighted... top 11 for some.
Hey, I was quick.
Or top 3/4 for Fernando of our VIF experience this year. So thank you for joining me, Fernando, Juan, Adam.
I only have 3 questions. Uh-huh. Throwback to Swan Song.
You can ask one question.
One question? Okay.
You can ask 11 questions.
What's the most important? Okay, I'll make it more movie related.
Okay.
So the phrase Swan Song, metaphorically, can refer to the final work, performance, or accomplishment shortly before retirement, fading from public life, or even death, a swan song. Dying 6 days after showing the studio a final cut of the movie, Stanley Kubrick didn't see the 1999 premiere of what film considered to be his swan song?
Eyes Wide Shut.
But that's not considered to be his well,
Eyes Wide Shut. Consider his swan song.
Well, you know, I'm a big Clockwork Orange, Shining, 2001 fan, but I know those are not the answers. I know those didn't come out in 1999.
We're now going to hear Juan's top 11.
His last movie was Eyes Wide Shut. He was getting ready to do Napoleon, and then he died.
Yeah.
And AI, artificial intelligence, was Spielberg, but then that never happened.
So, I mean, what threw you off is some consider it his best film.
Yes.
But definitely Eyes Wide Shut was his swan song.
Yes. But it ain't the Song of the Swan, even though it is his swan song.
It is Canada Goose song.
It is a goose song. Yeah. It is, yeah, it ain't his best.
We all have our goose song. Anyway.
Now, Lily, what's your top 11?
I'm out of here. Thank you to my guests again. Hopefully we'll see you guys all back soon. Again, this was The Real World, the UBC Film Society's official radio segment at CITR. Thanks for listening.